Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with last-minute efforts to avoid a default with all eyes on the United States Senate, where a deal is in the works, but what happens after that when it gets to the House remains uncertain. Jim Manley, who served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years and before that was an aide to Senator Ted Kennedy for 12 years, joins us with an assessment of the sudden bipartisanship and spirit of compromise on display between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. Then we'll speak with Tim Dickinson about his article in the current Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine, that reveals the role of Congressman Jim Jordan, the head of the shadow leadership team in the House known as the Jedi Council, that has been dogging Speaker Boehner at every turn and still may try to thwart him on avoiding a default, as well as challenge his leadership later should Boehner allow a vote of the full House before Thursday. Then finally, we'll look into the state of polarization in Washington with Keith Poole, a professor of political science at the University of Georgia and author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. We'll discuss the reasons why our politics have become so poisonous, polarized, and gridlocked, and whether the Republicans will pay a price for the Tea Party's unpopular exercise in government by extortion. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And it looks as though a deal is close The Senate Majority Leader and the Minority Leader have shown, a lot of grace and bipartisanship. So that seems to be the good news. But you tweeted fairly recently that Senator Ted Cruz could still tank the deal and cause a default. Tell me it's not true.
Yeah, it's entirely true. Under the rules of the Senate, any one senator has enormous ability to slow down, stop, and delay any particular piece of legislation that he or she chooses to do, if she or he decides to do so. He will be under enormous pressure, not only from the country, from the markets, but from his caucus as well, to try and make sure that doesn't happen. But we'll have to wait and see.
So his cohort, Mike Lee, they're both being pretty mum about it. I mean, one of the things I think the public doesn't recognize about this situation, particularly the extent to which the Tea Party caucus is driven to the right by its own constituents. I recall that Senator Mike Lee, he didn't even get elected, did he, in a caucus? He was essentially appointed by a few hundred people in a caucus. They got rid of a sitting U.S. senator who was very quite conservative, Bennett of Utah.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the Senate.
Isn't that a nightmare scenario? And does that ghost of that hang over a lot of this?
Well, let's just agree on this, that the ghost of the Tea Party is hovering over everything on Capitol Hill right now. The good news is that they are heading towards irrelevance. Whether they know it or not, that's a fact. The House Republicans, even at this late hour, keep on demanding changes of Obamacare. But I got a little tip for these guys. They're going to lose, and they're going to lose bad. They can either go along with this and make it easy, or they can do it the hard way. But if Senator Reid and Senator McConnell cut a deal, and I believe that they can, the handwriting's on the wall, and these guys are done.
So would the explanation then for Senator McConnell's apparent change of mind and his belated sense of bipartisanship and compromise, would that be to do with the recent polling? Because he's being challenged by a Tea Party guy, isn't he?
He sure is, and that's the great challenge here. Whatever he does, he's going to have to make sure that his fingerprints aren't too heavily involved on it. If not, that's only going to increase the pressure that he's facing from the right, especially back in the state. I joked earlier today to someone else that the reason why the meeting at the White House was canceled was because McConnell insisted that be the case, so he not be in a position where he's going to be at the White House with the president. This President Obama blessing the deal. So I'm wondering what he got out of it to make sure that the White House meeting was canceled. Now, that's a joke, bad or otherwise. The fact of the matter is the meeting was canceled because they were making so much progress. There was no need for a status check at the White House this afternoon, so that's all fine and well. But, yes, one of the hang-ups right now is that Democrats are hanging tough, determined to try and prevent additional cuts in domestic spending programs under the so-called sequester that are going into effect, that are scheduled to go into effect on January 15th. And Senator McConnell, for the reason we just described, under pressure from the Tea Party, is trying to avoid that happening.
So what about the next step, though? I mean, do we know? Of course, we don't know what's going to happen when it goes to the House, but we're running out of time, aren't we? So
we're running out of time. The deadline is hard and fast, the 17th. And again, as you probably know, Ian, there are still Republicans at this late hour that are suggesting that it doesn't matter if the country defaults. We can continue on this path for weeks, if not months. That's obviously a joke. But there is a little bit of cushion built in. We've got a whole $20 or $30 billion left after the 17th. So that provides a little bit of a window to get a deal done. But again, going back to what you asked me earlier, if Senator Cruz is serious and he's a man of principle, leaving aside what kind of principles he stands for, if he wants, he could delay debate on this bill for at least a week, if not a little bit more. So the pressure is going to be on McConnell and his caucus to get Cruz to back down. And then, like you said, all eyes go to the Senate. All eyes go to the House, and we'll see how they treat it.
Again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. So how can he – I understand the filibuster, and he did what has been widely referred to as a faux filibuster before, but how can Ted Cruz gum up the works for a whole week?
Again, under the rules of the Senate, any one senator has enormous responsibility or ability to try and stall, stop, and delay. First of all, you'll have to Reid will have to file a cloture on the motion to proceed to the bill. That'll take a couple days to process. Then Reid would have to file a cloture on the bill itself, and that'll take a couple days to process. And all of a sudden, you're at a week and a half. Again, but he is going to be facing enormous pressure from not only within his caucus, not that he cares, but also from the American people and the markets as well. The polling out in recent days, including a new Washington Post poll out tonight that I'm not sure many of your readers have read much about, is just devastating for the Republican brand. They're in tatters. They're in disarray. 74% of the American people in a poll out tonight, according to the Washington Post, disapprove of the Republican Party. Much of that blame can be laying directly at the feet of Ted Cruz and Mike Lee.
So do you think then that, they cannot be in an alternative universe to the extent that they don't notice this stuff, Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, surely?
I might have to disagree with you on that one, Ian. Those two guys in particular live in an alternative reality, a bubble that's dominated by Fox News and the right-wing media, where they think that they're winning. Senator Cruz, I believe, just as recently as yesterday, said on one of the Sunday shows that he believed that they were, Republicans, the Tea Party, were winning the debate. Now, all you have to do is to take a quick glance at the NBC Wall Street Journal poll last week to know that that's absolutely, of course, he disagreed with that poll, come to think of it. He said it was a skewed poll. But not only did it have the Republicans facing record-high approval numbers, but it actually showed an uptick in support for Obamacare. So the smart Republicans understand what the game is. I'm not so sure Senator Cruz and Senator Lee actually are in on the joke. Or actually, it's not a joke. It's pretty damn serious.
So this is then some people have argued, Nate Silver has argued, for example, that people's memories aren't that long. What's your sense as a 21-year veteran of the Senate? I don't. Well, we all know that we've never seen this before. This is, by the way, people forget that the government is actually shut down. There's two things going on here. They've shut down the government, and they're threatening to tank the economy. This is like a double-barrel shotgun, right?
You got it. So, yes, based on my years of experience, sometimes the American people's memory, for better or for worse, is a little set on a little too short term. But the fact of the matter is, as you just suggested, when the stock market tanks, when everyone's 401ks, which have been getting better in recent months, goes in the toilet again, no one's going to forget this, I can assure you. Certainly not in 2014 and even beyond that. These guys are just playing with fire. And they, again, the smart ones understand that that's the case. Some of the folks, you know, there's at least 30 or 50 Republicans of the House that don't get it, and there's a handful in the Senate that don't get it either. But they're about to wake up to a new cold, hard reality.
So, Jim Manley, you served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years, and then before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. If you were at Reid's side now, what do you think's going on? Do you think this is all about just holding the line? Because one of the bizarre things about this is that the Republicans are being both the arsonists and the fire brigade, you know.
Yep.
And it, I can't believe anybody takes this seriously. Like, how can they take themselves seriously when they're threatening to do such damage and then saying, oh, by the way, all you have to do is talk to us, you know. And you get the impression that that what they're trying to do, of course, is now they talk about compromise, having eschewed that term for some time now.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're talking about compromise. So you'd think that that maybe compromise might be in the wind. Is that, or do you think that, that both the president and Harry Reid can simply stand firm and say, just stop this nonsense and let's just have a clean CR and get this nightmare over with? Is that a lot of Democrats, particularly on the left, are very nervous about any kind of deal. So is there a deal in the works?
Well, there is a deal in the works to do a clean CR and to do a clean debt extension. What exactly is agreed upon beyond that remains to be seen, but those are secondary, tertiary issues. The president's going to stick to his word. He's not going to negotiate until, like I said, the government's open, until debt limit's extended. But the good news is I don't need to advise Senator Reid of anything right now because he sees it better than I do. And you know what he sees? He sees two things. Number one, he's got a united Democratic caucus where even Democrats up for re-election like Mary Landrieu and Pryor in Arkansas aren't afraid of having this debate. And then he looks around and he sees an increasing number of Senate Republicans that have had it with being jerked around by Ted Cruz and Mike Lee. And when he sees dynamics like that, he can tell the president, hold firm, we're going to win this. And I believe in the end that's what's going to be that's what's going to happen.
So this talk then that there's under discussion has been the removing the tax on medical devices, for example. There's some thought being given to repealing a $63 fee that companies must pay for each person they cover under the healthcare overall Obamacare beginning in 2014. That's sort of been leaking out.
Mm-hmm.
Through the cracks here. So, is Obamacare being talked about? Or I mean, I thought the deal was that you can't, you know, let's, you know, just stop this gun to the head business, and then we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, I mean, Obamacare—that's off the table. You know, full-scale assault on Obamacare, where there's repeal, implement, you know, 1 year delay in 1 year implementation, et cetera. Currently, the discussions involve, as you just suggested, doing away with the tax on medical devices. The theory was that since these guys were going to make a lot of money with the increased access to Obamacare, they should pay a tax. They're now talking about a delay of 1 or 2 years, will cost a couple $1 billion. And the other issue that I'm aware of is on the table is requiring some income eligibility requirements to get access to Obamacare, which I think most Democrats on face value don't have any problem with. Now, by some accounts, the Democrats are saying you can have one of these but not the other. But I don't think that anyone suggests or I don't think very many people on the Hill believe that should be an insurmountable issue. The real issue is, like I said, these sequester cuts and whether another round scheduled to go into January 15th, are going to go into effect. So one of the things they're talking tonight is setting up a series of negotiations that are supposed to end by the end of December to get our fiscal house in order and get some appropriations, set some appropriation guidelines to try and set some spending limits for next year.
So since it looks as though, just from the press conference with Senator Reid and Senator McConnell, and they're very gracious with each other, as though they were new best friends. Now, so assuming that we get this deal and it goes to the House, again, we discussed the uncertainty of it. Uh-huh. But what's your understanding of what's at play here? We're going to be covering the Jedi Council, as they're called, headed up by Jim Jordan, who seems to be the real challenger and he's got this Tea Party caucus in his pocket. You got Ryan there, who scuttled Senator Susan Collins deal on Saturday.
I mean, there's a guy by the name of Everett Burgess that's being quoted tonight as saying, you know, why in the heck did we shut down the government for 2 weeks and we're not going to get anything? I want something out of this. Well, here's a note to Congressman Burgess. You're not going to get anything. Look, the fact of the matter is there's somewhere between 30 and 50 House Republicans that are part of the Just Say No caucus. Okay, they're not going to vote for anything. I just saw another one of them on CNN, Raul Labrador, saying that unless there's cuts in entitlement spending, he's not going to vote for a debt limit. Well, again, note to Congressman Labrador, there's not going to be cuts in entitlement spending. So the question then is, how many Republicans are going to finally realize that the Republican brand is almost beyond repair, willing to vote for something along with Democrats? I think this is a deal that a majority of the House Democratic Caucus can vote for, along with, the required number of Republicans. And, you can get a deal done. But, again, I don't want to be, I'm a pessimist by nature. I learned that from Reid. So I don't mean to suggest that this is a done deal. What I do mean to suggest is that there's zero attempt. The Republicans have zero leverage right now. They can amend this thing and send it back to the Senate, risking the full faith and credit of the United States. But the Senate's just going to send it right back to them. So these guys are done. They're history. At least in the short term. The question is, what will this country have learned from this experience? And more importantly, what will House and Senate Republicans have learned from this experience? As I've suggested to you, there's a group of smart ones that understand that something's got to change. I'm not so sure how many of those guys there are, however, especially in the House.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn, Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the author of the article in the current Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tim Dinkinson, who is the National Affairs Correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine, who blogs at rollingstone.com. He covered the Obama campaign for Rolling Stone, and one of his articles, The Machinery of Hope, was anthologized as the best American political writing of 2008. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Dinkinson.
Glad to be with you.
And clearly things are coming down to the crunch on Monday night. The meeting has been postponed of the congressional leaders at the White House, and now it seems to be in the lap of Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. So assuming, and there's all kinds of kumbaya going on there between those two, which is unusual, but assuming that they make a deal, what happens at the House?
It's confusing. It sort of remains to be seen whether John Boehner has sort of, by giving the Tea Party faction of his conference the shutdown they were looking for, whether he gained himself enough political capital that he can bring a vote to the floor, and I think it will surely pass. But whether that is going to make certain members of his conference so angry that they're eager to seek new leadership is kind of an open question at this point. But it seems fairly clear that Boehner's determined to avoid a default if he can, but the question is just whether he'll do that if it means that he's giving up his power.
Well, I guess the Senate is basically, he'll be having to follow the Senate, and I take it it will probably mean that the Senate's basically saying, look, take it or leave it, aren't they? I mean, they don't want any more negotiation. There's not any time, is there?
No, there's not. And this fits a pattern where Boehner has sort of led from behind from the Senate. So the Senate approved the fiscal cliff deal by an overwhelming margin. The Senate approved the violence against women reauthorization and one or two other big votes that Boehner has sort of seen fit to use that as cover to bring a vote to the floor, even if it means that his conference, the majority of his conference, won't vote for it. And he has to rely on Nancy Pelosi and Democratic votes to get the business done. So it's a question of how many revolts he can really suffer in his own conference before it becomes perilous to his own continued viability as Speaker, whether there's real anger about whatever comes out of the Senate, in which case Boehner's sort of going to have to weigh his options, whether he lets the country go into default or whether he risks being toppled from his position.
Well, of course, it's worth reminding our audiences, Tim Dinkinson, that the government's already shut down. That's the second threat we're talking about, the default. I mean, it's almost like we've forgotten, as many have said, that in order for John Boehner to keep his job, hundreds of thousands of Americans have to lose their jobs. And that's the reality if you're a government employee at the moment. Now,
there's some irony to this, too. No, I would just say that there's some irony to this, too, because a couple of weeks ago it looked like Mitch McConnell was in a very, very perilous position and had sort of disappeared from these negotiations. It didn't look like he could step up and do anything at all for fear that he was going to he's got a Tea Party challenger in Kentucky coming up in the next election. And he seemed very cautious. And oddly, this move to shut down the government, being as unpopular as it is, seems to have given McConnell new life and new political rope to maneuver with and actually be forging a deal with Harry Reid in sort of a very familiar way. And so there's an odd way in which the shutdown, I think, did Mitch McConnell a big favor by just giving him more room to operate. And it may, in fact, be the thing that saves us from going the way of Detroit.
Well, Tim Dinkinson, your article Inside the Republican Suicide Machine in the current issue of Rolling Stone, I learned a lot about the inner workings of the Republican Party, and particularly in the context of this shutdown, of who the real protagonists are. And I wasn't aware of the important role of the Republican Study Committee, which has 174 members of the 232 House Republicans. Its former chair, Jim Jordan of Ohio, seems to be the sort of shadow speaker in these internal battles going on. According to your article, he sits on a shadow leadership team, which has been dubbed the Jedi Council. So let's assume that there's some adult supervision here and that Reid and McConnell come through with this deal and it goes back to Boehner, and Boehner really has no choice but to open it up to the full House and meaning the Democrats and the moderate Republicans will get it over the top. And then you'll have this bitter backlash from the Jedi Council, Jim Jordan, and the Tea Party people. What then happens to Boehner and his leadership?
Right. Well, this is the open question. I mean, the thing to understand is that Jim Jordan commands what I talk about as a faction of 50, 50 members, more or less. It's a shifting coalition depending on the issue that has worked very openly in defiance of Boehner and his prerogatives, always trying to move Boehner to the right. And this is particularly evident in party line votes where they're trying to do something big and strategic. You know, it's interesting that, you know, the House Republicans haven't introduced their own plan to avoid a default, and it's basically because they can't get enough unity in their own conference to even put an offer on the table. And part of the reason for that is this sort of faction of 50 that won't go along and will deprive a Republican speaker, Boehner, of the majority that he needs to pass legislation on a party line basis. And so the question is, how limited is that faction? Is that faction 50? Is it 70? Is it, you know, how many people are really, really going to be angry about this move? And it only takes 50 folks to vote for a special conference that would bring a new leadership election. And so if you've got a faction, if this, you know, core faction of 50 swells in size on this issue to, you know, 100 or so, you could have a real honest-to-goodness revolt, and we could see a change in leadership. And it may not just stop at Boehner. There's a possibility that it could be, you know, the entire leadership team that gets riled in this outrage. But I don't know. It's hard to say at this point whether, you know, this sort of hardcore faction of the GOP is at all chastened by what's going on in the poll numbers and sort of burnt out from the experience of having done something as dramatic as shutting down the government, whether they're really united or able to unite a larger coalition against, you know, in favor of defaulting on the debt.
Again, I'm speaking with... sorry. I know, it's hard to keep up with the disasters. Needless to say, there are two concurrent ones going, shutting down the government and threatening to tank the economy by a default. Again, I'm speaking with Tim Dickinson, who is a national affairs correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine. He blogs at rollingstone.com, and he covered the Obama campaign for Rolling Stone. And one of his articles, The Machinery of Hope, was anthologized as the best American political writing of 2008. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. But if it only takes those 50 votes to open up a committee to look for to open up a vote for a new speaker, normally they vote the speakers in when the new Congress is seated. But if you can get a special vote going, wouldn't the Democrats, they get to vote too, don't they?
They do, and so there's always a danger that you need to have the backup candidate well positioned. You know, you can't sort of go into this thing blind. There has to be some strategy behind it, although House Republicans haven't been behaving in a particularly strategic fashion lately. So that is a question of whether this is just an emotional move. I mean, we're getting several steps ahead of ourselves, even assuming that this sort of thing happens. But the speaker is elected by a majority of the House altogether. And so there's an outside chance that Nancy Pelosi briefly could emerge with the speakership again if Republicans are divided and Democrats stay united around her. But these are sort of outlying possibilities. But I think it's just really going to be an interesting question to see whether this exercise in shutting down the government has gotten enough of the yah-yahs out of the, you know, the Ted Yohos and Louis Gohmerts. Have they exercised whatever destructive impulse they needed to exercise by shutting down the government, and they're now going to go along with something that increases the debt ceiling and reopens the regular functioning of government, or are they sort of retrenched in a place that they're feeling they need to take an even harder line? And
well, I guess what I was getting at,
the moderate Boehner.
Sure, but what I was interested in, you know, I want to get off this subject, but just before we do, I wanted to find out whether or not Jim Jordan, the head of the Jedi Council, the shadow leader, the guy that's behind this push, this Tea Party push that's making Spain are so uncomfortable, apparently, whether or not he has ambitions to be the Speaker. I mean, that most politicians are pretty ambitious, or does he enjoy being the kind of, you know, the guerrilla leader behind the scenes?
Well, it's interesting, because I don't know that Jordan has, you know, majority support within his conference. He's got a large number of supporters and a core group that's numbering in the dozens. And so it's a question of, if he were to stand forward, does he gather enough of the Boehner block? Boehner has his own block of about 50 members, too. And so are those folks who would rally behind Jordan, or would they gravitate towards somebody more like... I mean, the only person I could see sort of standing as a plausible Speaker candidate is Paul Ryan, frankly. He's the sort of one who has enough currency among the RSC members and sort of more establishment Republicans. You know, he's the one guy who I can see sort of bridging that gap if it's not, you know, Cantor or Boehner.
I see. Well, let's turn to the other aspect of one of the things, other things in your article in Rolling Stone, Tim Dickinson, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. And I've done some coverage on this earlier about the Williamsburg Accords, which took place shortly after the stinging defeat in 2012. The Republicans went to this retreat in Williamsburg to lick their wounds. And at that meeting, they came up with the Williamsburg Accord, which essentially is the culmination of that strategy that they worked out, isn't it? Where they would simply not negotiate with the White House or the Senate and force Obama to come to them.
Right. But it's interesting because the Williamsburg Accord didn't have anything about a government shutdown in it. And in fact, had sort of. So the idea was that they got together at this retreat in Williamsburg, Virginia, and the Jedi Council was sort of brought in by Boehner to sort of say, okay, well, conservatives, what do you want to do? I'm tired of fighting with you. I'm tired of having coup attempts against me. I want to unite my conference, unite my team. Conservatives, let's set the agenda together, and I'm going to move to the right instead of trying to get you to follow me out towards the center. And so they devised this whole plan to force a debt ceiling fight, and they thought it was going to happen in the spring, but the government ended up with a lot more money, both from tax revenue and from Fannie Mae, than was expected. And so they had this very carefully plotted strategy, and it was all going to be centered around getting the budget on a 10-year path to balance, which is what Paul Ryan's budget now calls for. And so it was. You know, at least a pretty sophisticated negotiating strategy, but it was actually had some flexibility towards it so that you could count something like change CPI, which is the change in Social Security benefits for future retirees that President Obama has in his own budget, and you could count that on this 10-year time horizon and, you know, keep the debt ceiling, raise it for a few months with that. You know, so you could, there were sort of ways that the president could be coaxed into kicking the can down the road a little bit and avoiding a default by, you know, embracing things that he had put in his own budget. And so it actually was a fairly sophisticated negotiating strategy. And what happened is this government shutdown stuff got in the way and sort of scrambled that strategy completely, such that the first opening in the debt ceiling negotiations was something about the Keystone Pipeline and tax incentives for oil drillers, and it just had nothing to do with this sort of carefully plotted strategy that they formulated, and that's largely due to these outside groups and Ted Cruz, who came in and advised this shutdown fight over Obamacare, which has been roundly self-defeating.
So, does this mean that Ted Cruz has sufficient charisma that he can get these guys riled up and strapping on the suicide vests and marching off the cliff?
Well, it's not just Ted Cruz. It's the whole machinery behind Ted Cruz that encompasses the Heritage Foundation, it's the Club for Growth, it's Heritage Action, it's the Senate Conservatives Fund. It's a series of outside groups that play. They score different votes, and they will primary Republicans who are deemed insufficiently conservative, sort of, you know, brand them as Republicans in name only and go after them with well-funded primary opponents. And so it exercises this whip function that people don't want to get on the wrong side of these groups and their scorecards. And they made this the campaign of the summer. They sort of hijacked August and made this charge on the hill of Obamacare, you know, that was had about as much chance of success as Custer's last run, but sort of made that the cause celeb of the moment in Republican circles and activist circles. And at the end of the August recess, you had this group coming back of 80 or so members who were insisting on this as a precondition for moving forward, and so we ended up with a shutdown government. So, it is partly Ted Cruz's charisma, but there's a whole machinery behind Ted Cruz that you need to understand why this actually happened.
So, obviously, I'm finding it difficult to understand how they could do what they're doing and have these such negative results so quickly. Polls saying that the Democrats are going to pick up the House now as a result and that the Republicans won't be able to take back the Senate. All the polls are coming out today, and you just mentioned a change of fortune for Mitch McConnell against his Tea Party challenge. So it's like reality is coming in like a monster wave, you know? And I'm just surprised that these guys, do they live in a bubble or something? Didn't they understand that this would be the likely response, or are they so consumed by their zeal and righteousness that they just were blind to the consequences?
I think it's a combination of things, but you have to understand this. There's about 100 members of the House conference for whom reality, outside reality, doesn't really matter very much, because their biggest threat is not that they're going to be challenged by some moderate Democrat in a general election. Their seats are in these so-called landslide districts that are basically impossible for a Republican to lose. And so they need to guard against the anger of an activist base who's going to say, you know, why didn't you stand with Ted Cruz? Why weren't you righteous and fighting these evil Democrats and the socialism of Obamacare? And so their reality is very insular and different from the actual political realities in America. And so their political calculus is quite different. And in fact, you know, most of these folks got elected by promising to take a stand and repeal Obamacare. And so these folks are, in fact, are representing their constituents in a surprising way. It's just that their districts are drawn so strangely that the people who are not turning against Republicans right now are the people who are stocked in those districts. So there's actually not that much political risk for individual members. There's real consequences for the larger Republican team, but for many of these members, there's going to be no political fallout for having fought this fight. And in fact, there probably would have been grave fallout if they hadn't.
Well, we just have to close now, Tim Dickinson, but you talk about this young 50-year-old Tea Party leader with the Freedom Works organization, Matt Kibbe. I think Freedom Works, I think, is funded by the Kochs. But in any case, you ask him about the House today, and he says with a wry smile, "Beautiful chaos." So, now that the Kochs have sent their letter to the Senate saying that, you know, we're not behind the default, maybe we should ask for another comment from Matt Kibbe, right?
I'm not sure that Freedom Works is. I think they may be splintered from the Kochs, but there's an element to which. But again, all of this stuff is just it's very complicated. But there's an element to which this is. Just interesting that we call these folks conservatives when, in fact, they're behaving in the most radical fashion possible. And as folks like Kibbe sort of point out, it's actually sort of an anarchist impulse. Like they just want to blow things up and see where the chips lie rather than being strategic.
I see. Well, okay. Well, I think I may be wrong on who funds Freedom Works, but it's obviously, if it's not the Kochs, it's another like-minded billionaire. And I thank you for joining us, Tim Dickinson.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Dickinson, who's the National Affairs Correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine, and he blogs at rollingstone.com. He covered the Obama campaign for Rolling Stone, and one of his articles, The Machinery of Hope, was anthologized in the Best American Political Writing of 2008. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston Professor in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology and Congress, and of Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Thank you.
And clearly at this point, the Senate is taking the lead in trying to avoid the default. The president has canceled his meeting with the congressional leaders in the White House on Monday and is now, he was actually being out at a charity event. And pretty much, I guess the impression we all have is that everything is pretty much in the hands of Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. But then what happens with the House?
It's going to depend a lot on whether or not there is enough in the compromise for, say, to get 50 or 60 votes in the caucus, Republican caucus, or it might go down on the floor if it gets to the floor. So they're going to have to, whatever deal they strike, there's going to have to be enough in there for the, I guess you might call the sane group, which would be the normal conservatives, over to the remainder of the party. So you need to get probably enough, 100 or more of the Republicans to go along to get it passed. And so far, they've been pretty closed-mouthed about what's in this deal. And so until we know a few more details, it's not clear whether or not it'll get through the House or not.
Well, since you are a student of polarization in American politics, Keith Poole, give us the Keith Poole meter on where things stand. Has it ever been this bad?
No, this is the worst it's been since the end of the Civil War. So that this is the worst, the most polarized the system has been since the era of Reconstruction, which was after the Civil War up to about 1876. We've never seen the two major parties divided to this extreme, and indeed, just since the last major shutdown, which occurred under Speaker Gingrich in late 1995 into 1996, the Republican Party has moved significantly to the right, to the point where Gingrich would be, if he still served in the House, would be in the left side of the caucus. So that's how dramatically Republicans have shifted to the right just in the last 20 years. And that means it's just extremely difficult to do any wheeling and dealing and horse trading because you're dealing with a very large group of true believers.
So in terms of the presidency then, as a historian, Keith Poole, have you ever seen this kind of disrespect and disdain voiced and regularly spewing out?
Well, it was pretty bad under George W. Bush, who was widely vilified. And then before that, the last few years of Bill Clinton, Clinton's presidency was pretty conflictual. So this has been building up over quite a span of time. In contrast, the first George Bush, people liked, widely liked, so that the last three presidents, which interestingly enough is the first time since the sequence of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe, that the U.S. has had three two-term presidents in a row. We've had this slow build-up, and it really shot up under President Bush, and then
President Obama has not gotten a break in that the Republican support for him started out about 30% and went down to 10% and hasn't moved.
So is there an explanation for this to your mind?
There is a lot of things that have contributed to this. Some of this is just a very perverse, it's like in a public address meeting when you get a squeal, like a feedback. Part of this is just a feedback, but there are two major things that have contributed to it. First, all the white Southerners switched to the Republican Party. It took about 35 years to do that, but they have. And that means that the old Southern moderates that used to be kind of the balance wheel, I'm talking about post-Jim Crow, post-civil rights laws. In other words, the Sam Nunns and the Jimmy Carters have all been replaced by conservative Republicans. And then the other thing that has dramatically altered the Republican Party, in addition to that, was the Goldwater campaign in 1964, and that created this nationwide network and cadre of conservative activists. And a good example of that was Newt Gingrich. And they just slowly took over the Republican Party at the grassroots and almost across the entire country, practically. And that has shifted the party dramatically to the right. And then the disappearance of the Southern Democrat moderates has made the Democratic Party more homogeneous. So even though the Democratic Party hasn't really shifted to the left that much, most of the polarization is being produced by the Republican Party shifting to the right. We're now in really, really deep trouble because not only do we have a really sick economy, but there just aren't any deal makers left like Robert Dole and Chuck Percy and that group of leaders. They're not there anymore.
Again, I'm speaking with Keith Poole, who's the Philip H. Alston Professor in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology and Congress, and of Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. Now, but surely, first of all, we've never had a default. If this happens in the next couple of days, it will be a first time in history. Is there any precedent for this kind of government by extortion, holding the gun to the head right up to the point where, you know, you're about to pull the trigger and the whole global economy is like to take a massive hit? I, frankly, have never heard of it and seen it before. Is there anything approximating this in your historical research?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. We didn't start doing this debt ceiling until World War I. And before that, the United States never had a so-called debt ceiling type arrangement. We've had a lot of confrontations between Congress and the President and over budget issues, but the 2011 and now the 2013 crises are, we've had sort of conflicts over raising money before, but in the context of this hyper-polarization, I would say that this is unprecedented and extremely dangerous, yes.
So what has changed then in polarization? We don't need to go back to Reconstruction, but let's just take the post-war era. A lot of people say it's the 24-hour news cycle, it's gerrymandering. Is there any one explanation?
No, there's no one explanation. We just had a piece in Bloomberg on gerrymandering. It's pretty clear it's not gerrymandering. I think one of the things that's been going on is that every single issue, from raising taxes to immigration to gun control, gun rights, every single issue now is voted on in Congress on liberal conservative terms. What's happened and what's new in this period of American history is that there are no cross-cutting issues left. That is, issues that used to divide the parties internally and therefore dampen down conflict. Now, for example, it used to be that there were pro-life Democrats and pro-choice Republicans on abortion, and with the exception of, say, local officials, that's pretty much disappeared at the national level, so that abortion now is essentially an issue that at one time divided the parties and no longer divides them. So all these issues now are reinforcing this division. And then there are some deeper issues, namely the rise of income inequality has exacerbated this. And furthermore, there's now very, very solid evidence that there's a tremendous amount of sorting, geographic sorting has taken place, so that I think his name is Bill Bishop of the Austin, I think it's Austin Daily Statesman newspaper, wrote a book on the Big Sort. But there's also been a lot of work since then that shows that people, Democrats are now concentrated in the cities and parts of the suburban rings, and Republicans are concentrated in rural areas and parts of the suburbs, and more people are sorting out. So that, say, if you want to put a flag on your house, you're very uncomfortable living in a neighborhood where you don't see very many flags. One of the biggest things that are dividing people are religion and whether or not you believe in traditional marriage. So that, and with the multiplication of media outlets, you can pick the news and the reinforcing information that you want. And so this sorting is exacerbating things tremendously. And people aren't exposed to other points of view. So I'm not sure, you know, I don't have any easy answers for you because it's a dynamic process. We're in the middle of it. It's not clear exactly how it got started, but it seems to be getting worse with every election.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed, Keith Poole, is that this business of primarying people, where the primary election is more important than the general election, particularly it's happening now on the Republican side, and how special interest groups primary candidates and knock them off. Now, you mentioned Senator Chuck Percy. He was knocked off, and he was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was knocked off by the Israel lobby, as was Senator Fulbright. So those were the only examples that I could think of through most of the post-war period, but now it's routine, it seems, where special interest groups like the Club for Growth and others are going after people or threatening people. So has that changed? In other words, going back to Fulbright and Percy, it seemed to be unusual that a special interest lobby group would be able to run somebody against them and fund them in unlimited ways, as AIPAC did, to get rid of the two chairmen of the House Foreign Relations Committee that they didn't like back during the Vietnam War and after. Has that become more of the norm?
Yeah, it seems to be. It seems to be more of a norm. What people forget, like my Depression era parents had these sayings. One of them is, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." And one of the reasons why it's easy for these groups to go after people in primaries is that the McCain-Feingold messed up a perfectly good campaign finance system, namely the soft money. And the soft money went to political parties for the most part. And having all this money now sloshing around in the system that's not under direct party control means that it's a lot easier to go after incumbents in these party primaries. That's clearly one of the causes of this. And if, for example, if the parties had more control over the money, you wouldn't have gotten, you know, Mike Castle would have been elected in Delaware, for example. So, yeah, I think that is one of the things that's happening. But it's hard to disentangle that from this process where people are becoming more sorted out, more, and the activists are getting more and more extreme over time. And, again, this is one of these, it's a feedback type of effect that one thing happens and it reinforces another thing, and around it goes.
Well, Keith Poole, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You bet.
Again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston Professor in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and of Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back a week from today, next Monday. I'm going to Australia tonight for the premiere of a film that I made for the BBC in 1968 that was shown once, then destroyed because it was too controversial. Fortunately, the director of the film recently discovered a print of the film, and the documentary was reconstructed by the ABC in Australia. It will be shown for the first time in 45 years at the Sydney Opera House this coming Thursday night. And I'm lucky to have, as a substitute host this week while I'm away, one of the world's leading media and culture critics, Toby Miller. He'll be sitting in for me this coming week, and I'll be back again a week from today. Bye for now. Time.